Happy Bitcoin Friday, freaks. It's your host, Odell, here for another Citadel Dispatch, the interactive live show focused on actionable freedom tech and Bitcoin discussion. As always, I want to thank the many individuals in our audience who continue to support the show using Bitcoin. Citadel Dispatch has no ads or sponsors. It is supported purely from Bitcoin donations from our audience. So to all those who continue to support the show, thank you. I appreciate you. The easiest way to support Dispatch is through podcasting 2.0 apps like Fountain, Podverse.fm, Breeze Wallet. You simply install the app like any other podcast app. Choose how many sats per minute, how much Bitcoin per minute you think the show is worth, and that Bitcoin streams directly to my wallet. You can also do something called boostergrams, where you attach a message to an amount of sats. And the top four boostergrams I read out from last week's episode. We have at Cumrocket with 69,420 sats saying, do the Bitcoin, stay humble and stack sats. Appreciate it. We have at random user with 55,555 sats saying, what's the episode referenced in the Adam and Jack episode with the Silk Road dude who did jail time? Search TFTC John Doe for that. We have at Eric99 with 50,000 sats saying, stay humble, stack sats. Thank you, Eric99. Great advice. And we have at Ape Mythrender with 7,777 sats saying, I think 10 more Nostr podcasts and I might give it a go. Well, there's going to be a lot more Nostr focus going forward. We also have a new live chat and a new Nostr stream that you can access by going to citadeldispatch.com/stream. That uses your Nostr NPub to sign in, and you can zap sats. You can send Bitcoin transactions directly in the chat. So cheers to the freaks joining us for that. And then last but not least, I know it's a bear market. I know it's a recession. The easiest way to support the show is subscribing and leaving a review and listening through your favorite platform. Dispatch is available on all the major platforms, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, Bitcoin TV, every podcast app. You just search Citadel Dispatch on that favorite platform. And it's important to remind everyone, if you're not listening to this live, that Dispatch is always broadcast live as a live interactive show. We have a live chat on YouTube that is streamed directly into the broadcast. And as I said earlier, now we have this Nostr chat at citadeldispatch.com/stream. So thank you to the guests. Thank you to the audience members who continuously show up for the live shows and make it unique with your comments and your questions. Couldn't do it without you. So anyway, that's my intro. This is a great conversation that I'm very excited about. I'm really looking forward to it. We have a really good friend joining us. We have Russell Okun, former, I guess, forever Super Bowl champion, Bitcoiner, joining us today after a 40-day fast. Russell, how's it going?
I'd first like to say that I'm changed, man. And I don't think I'll ever be the same. And then, I've been on my knees praying since 3 a.m. this morning for this audience. For every person who decides to listen, to share the time with us, okay, I'm praying for you. I'm praying for those who are in the know and who are walking in truth, essentially seeing the world through a different lens. I pray for you. I pray for those who feel misunderstood, not heard. I'm lifting you up. So I'd first like to give our praise and honor to the Most High God, the God of Ibrahim. And I say to all those who are listening, in the tongue of my forefathers in Como, Bekala Salam, peace and peace unto you. So, Matt, thank you so much for having me on, brother.
Thank you for coming on. And thank you for everything you do and what you stand for. And thank you for being a friend. I don't know where we should really start. You just completed a 40-day fast. Before that, I mean, before the 40-day fast, you did something that I have a ton of respect for, which is you spent a large portion of your life in the public eye, and you just stepped away. You just stepped away. You stepped into, I guess, a greater focus into family life and priorities and getting your life in order. Let's talk about that for a little bit. When did that happen? Was that over a year ago?
Yeah. It was over a year ago, and actually less than a year ago. Since I've been 10 years old, man, I've had people, you know, watching me, right, and shouting praise and, you know, affirming me. You know, and I've always, it's become a large part of who I am, right, in terms of performing for society or, you know, in the public eye. You know, but after my last season with the Carolina Panthers, I was just taking a hard look and, you know, into the mirror, looking at my family, my children, and trying to figure out, like, who's the man I want to be? I've always kind of been preparing for transition in some ways out of the NFL, but you kind of really never know when it's going to come, you know, and you have people that just kind of, you know, this abruptly happens to, and you have some people who can decide when they want to leave. And you have others who are forced out of the game. And I just was looking in the mirror. And I knew it was becoming increasingly hard to get up every morning. Like my body was in pain. And I was, you know, just trying to figure out what was next to Carolina. Teams were calling me. They wanted to sign me. They're offering me money. I'm just like, I was having issues with my wife. And I couldn't emotionally connect with my wife and my children and my family. I just knew something needed to change. All right. So that's ultimately, you know, what drove me to the fast, is it wasn't some desire for weight loss as most people would proclaim. It was a desire to be a better son, a better husband, a better father, a better person. Like, I wanted that, right? I wanted to be a better leader. I know there are a lot of people who look to me who are depending on me. So I had to just cut down everything and focus. That same skill I've had in achieving these feats in the professional football field, I wasn't doing that same thing with my family, with my loved ones, those who are closest to me. And so I just took that same energy and that effort, and I reoriented it. I redirected it to them. And I got to tell you, Matt, it has been the best thing I've ever done. The best thing I've ever done.
It's inspiring. It's inspiring, my dude. Let's talk about that. So, I mean, the headlines would have you believe that it was all about weight loss. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a crazy number. What is the number? I guess I should know it. I'm the host. But the number is insane, how much weight you lost.
Yes, I was 330 pounds, you know, after I finished with Carolina and going up 330 pounds. So that's when I did my first fast. And then this more recent one, you know, I lost roughly, you know, 50 to 60 pounds.
I mean, I saw a number 190. Was that an accurate number or is that bullshit?
I still can't believe it, but like, it's an accurate number. But 192, I believe.
Oh, wow. That's insane. I mean, you lost like a whole person worth of weight.
Man, I haven't been at light since eighth grade.
Okay. But it wasn't about weight loss at all.
No, not at all. Nah, man, it was about all the things that I mentioned. And I think, since I've had more of this time to myself and I don't have all of these demands, I've really been getting into history more, and I've been tapping into some of my family's practices. I went to Africa, I'm in the bush, I'm in the village, and I'm seeing and remembering our cultures and belief system, and fasting has always been a very intrinsic part of the culture I come from. Like I was a child and I remember, my family dry fasting, no water, no food, right? Just so determined, right, to see their lives change. And it was crazy, if not insane, that I found myself at that same chasm. And I said, okay, I want to do this for myself. So I think, like, in the very essence of fasting, right, it suggests that things are not well, right? Well, particularly fasting in this way, right? That if you see fasting as a fundamental component, right, of our culture, of our existence, right, to refrain from it, right, especially when it's in the natural order of life, it implies that one is looking for disruption. You're looking for disruption, right? And I guess in some ways I was reflecting on the chaotic state of affairs of the world, right? And I wanted to look in that mirror, and fasting is interesting because it kind of brings out the deepest things in you. And I noticed, right, it almost intensified, what I think was laying dormant. So I was experiencing crazy highs of sorrow and abnormality. Right? I was being confronted with all of these raw emotions, right, and the tragedy, of things that I've gone through in life that I just kind of pushed aside, not even tried to think about. Right. And the best thing about it, though, was I witnessed the fragility of my life, right? That my life can be gone at any moment in time. Right? And it's been beautiful because I've emerged with newfound strength, with resilience. And I think it's a practice which is completely underestimated, right? Particularly in a culture which is obsessed with consumption.
Yep.
I can talk too much, so feel free to cut me off.
No, I'm just going to let you run for as until you realize that I'm letting you run, and then I'm going to jump in. That's my strategy. It was almost a reset, right?
Yeah. It's, I think I was living in pain for so long. You kind of think it's your best friend. You almost expect things to be this way. You're like, okay, this hurts, or I'm dealing with this ailment or this sickness. And you just figure, for whatever reason, this is just how life is supposed to be. Right? You normalize it. And I think that is one of the most dangerous things you can do. And look, I'm not a medical professional. And I just want to preface anything I say that it's not what I do for a living. Right? So I put myself out there twice now. And I've learned that this is a historical, ancient practice that's pretty prevalent in many other cultures, just not in the West.
Yeah, I mean, Russ, I can relate to the fact that our society is unfortunately incredibly focused on consumption. This conversation is mostly going to be me relating to you as a friend, because I have zero qualifications to talk about fasting or even spiritual finding your spirituality. I try, but I'm definitely by no means well versed. I'm still learning on my side. When you think about, I guess I don't even know where I want to go with this. Okay, so 40-day fast. We went through a 40-day fast. You went through a 40-day fast. I didn't do shit.
We did.
But you're still not really. I mean, you're not eating solid foods right now, right?
No, I'm still drinking just juiced raw fruits and vegetables.
Okay. So how long have you been doing that for? That's been how many days?
So it's a week regimen. So for about a week, it's nothing but raw fruits and vegetables, just juiced. Right. And I'm pretty careful about the sort of glycemic index. So I try not to pick fruits that are high in sugar. So that's the challenge, the thing about fasting is the refeeding procedure is just as important. Some people just say, okay, we'll withdraw, and then they come back in, they're eating meat.
Right.
And the body can only handle so much. When you have depleted yourself and, your body's now eating its own fat reserves, I think trying to impart too much into the body can be very dangerous. But again, if we're looking at this from the lens of seeing it as an ancient practice, people hundreds, if not thousands of years ago didn't have food readily available. You couldn't just choose and say, I'm going to eat all this.
Right.
Today, right.
Hunt and gather and time would go on while you were in between meals naturally.
Seriously. It was a couple of times when I'd be sleeping, for the very little amount of time every little sound could wake me up, right? I would be chewing in my sleep. it was insane. I was on straight, fight or flight mode. I could smell everything. I could be outside and you could smell the trees had a distinct smell, the grass, fruit. I remember one time somebody from my family was drinking wine. It was very, it's rich. It was a very rich smell, and I couldn't believe I had tapped in. I feel like I tapped into something.
And I see a lot of people try and tap into that, myself included, by what's almost become a fad, which is this intermittent fasting, which is, you do much shorter fast than 40, incredibly shorter fast than 40 days. Maybe you skip a meal or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is just a whole nother level. 40 days. I mean, longer than 40 days, essentially, with no solid food. I do wonder if from a strictly nutrition point of view, if I would die because I didn't start with so much, muscle and fat that you started with.
Yeah, I think that's something to pay attention to. I underrated. I don't want you to die. But I've read studies, right? There is information in regards to one prepping to fast.
Right.
So whether that is increasing your caloric intake, fats and proteins, so if you're saying, hey, I want to fast for X amount of time, you can prepare yourself to do so, just by taking some things up I can send you some of them at some point. If not, maybe I'll just put it on Twitter so people can just kind of read it for themselves, but it's, I've seen people much leaner than me do it. I've seen people much larger than me do it, I think it's something that, I think requires an understanding of your own uniqueness.
But this is something you think everyone should do at some point?
So when my family, right, when I told them I was fasting, one of my uncles laughed at me. He was like, oh yeah, you're fasting? He's like, how long? I'm like, 40 days. He's like, okay, no problem. We're going to fast with you. He has a family of like maybe like 6 or 7, right? And like, he essentially made a decision, you know, in proxy of his family to say, everybody's fasting, right, for 40 days. Can you imagine that? Like, he's just like, that's how normal it is, right, in the culture I come from, to fast.
Right.
Right. And it's like, he's much smaller than me, you know? And, but to him is just like, this is not just an action, right? It's a way of life. It's a lifestyle. Right? And, you know, I think it's, so I think everybody.
Wait, so did they do it with you?
Yes.
They did all 40 days.
Well, I think 4 of them dropped.
Fair.
The last 3, which were the oldest ones, stayed on. And they're 70 plus. So two or 70 plus that stayed on. And then one of them was 40. And the other one ended up dropping.
The young guns let the ball down.
Right. And you know what's crazy? My uncle, he told me, yeah, I'm thinking about doing another 30 days after the 40-day fast. Right? He's like, I'm going to do 70. I'm like, what? Like, you are insane.
But, and this is a full fast, right? This is not like a Ramadan fast where you just eat during nights, or this is a full no food.
No food, no electrolytes, no supplementation.
Just
no,
water.
Just water.
It's incredibly impressive. It's incredibly impressive.
You know, it's weird, you know, and I mentioned like the sort of fragility of life earlier. Because I've had people who would ask me, you know, in the middle of the fast, and they would say, aren't you afraid of dying? And I got to the point where I was just like, no. Because in some ways, I was seeing the improvements in my family, the closeness I was having with my wife. I remember my son, he's so bright. He's amazing. My oldest son, you know. He's the one that can actually, you know, communicate much more than others, you know. And he has seen me meet all types of people. He is, knows I did football. He knows, certain levels of my gifting. He's never like applauded me ever. And one day we're sitting downstairs. I'm watching him eat, right, and like he's just carving it up. And he says, you know, he calls me Baba. He says, Baba, one day I'm going to be like you. I am going to fast just like you, Baba, for 40 days. That might have been one of the most beautiful things. I get choked up thinking about this. As a person who lost her father at his roughly around his same age, right, who didn't have male role models, who had to essentially make their life and grow up very quick, right? Like, it touched me. It touched me that my oldest son, the one who looks just like me, who wants to, is saying, I want to be like you, not because of football, not because of where I think your intelligence is, but because you are fasting, you are depriving yourself for our family. He gets it. And man, I forgot the question. As you asked, you know, but.
Well, you answered the better question. I mean, Russ, you said if family, there's a massive focus here. I mean, we touched on it a little bit before we went live, but, you know, how do you view this? It's so interesting. This idea of being a football player, an American football player, as a career, and then transitioning out of it—it's unlike other. It's unique in terms of careers or professions, in terms of how dramatic that change can be, both intentionally and unintentionally. A lot of times, you know, for players, it can be unintentional, and or they get an injury or something, and then it just ends. How has your experience with that transition been, and particularly from a perspective of family and time being able to spend with your family?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, I miss the locker room. I really miss, I miss men getting together, having a goal. You know, because, you know, we huddle up, right? We huddle up, the quarterback essentially disseminates whatever the play is, right? We have a goal, right? And our opposition, they also have a goal, right? And their goal is to stop us, right? The defense, their goal is to stop us, like, you know, while I'm on offense. Right? And, you know, football was an opportunity to practice that every single day for 10, 12 hours a day, right? So I miss that. I miss the locker rooms. I miss, you know, achieving things and seeing your achievement in real time. You know, it's sports is much more linear, you know, as opposed to life, which is exponential. You know, certain things happen and can change all the time. And you talk to George, and, you know, George McHale, you know, my brother-in-law, he's talked a lot about the social layer, you know, of Bitcoin. We spend a lot of time, you know, working on that. You know, and, you know, we've both had our challenges, you know. And look, I read The Sovereign Individual, like most Bitcoiners, right? And I'm very impressed, you know, with a future where there can be technological advancements, right? And the rise of a digital currency and a decentralized society. But I worry sometimes, right, that perhaps there are too many ideals of anarchy and libertarianism. We're advocating for individual sovereignty. Maybe those things take too much of the forefront. Now, I'm with it, man. You know, when it comes to minimal government interference, I'm with that, right? But I also want to recognize the challenges, right, that I think trying to solely discuss empowering the individual, right, can have. You know, and I keep going back to my family's understanding. You know, and you know, my family is they're modeling what's modeling called Nigeria, right? And but we hold traditions and migration patterns throughout the entire continent, right? And I grew up appreciating the beauty of the part of my American heritage and experience, but I think there are values which can be gleaned from cultures outside, right, of the U.S. You know, and I think that's something which, you know, is often missed, or it's not a perspective I would like to see, you know, as much, right? Like, I've been thinking a lot through, obviously with proper context here, you know, this, the idea of a state or a consortium of states, right? They're operating as these distinct territories. And I come from something which is more of a tribe, you know, where, right, you know, this tribe is not like a state where it has this kind of sovereign polity. Right. But instead, a tribe is a social and ethnic, if not political, cohesive group of people. Right. So I've been wrestling with this concept of this tribal function, right, state versus the sovereign individual thing. Right. Because while the sovereign individual seeks autonomy and self-governance and freedom, right, all things which are valuable, a tribal society, like, also functions from a decentralized form of power, right? And, you know, you can also build up a sense of personal agency and independence, which at the same time aligns itself with the ideas of the sovereign individual, right? So, there, I mean, I can riff on that, but, you know, when I think about making this change, you know, I see many people are in the Bitcoin space as family, if not closer than my blood family, right? And I think that's something which needs to be tapped into. These are things that can only happen by humans coming together, right? I hate when people confuse the idea of an audience, you know, in a community. I hate it, right? Because a community requires people to truly be together. Right? I love what you're doing in Nashville, by the way. I want to make sure I recognize that, right? Because you understand human interaction. Right? There's things that cannot be done without that. Right? And like, I think we need more of that.
You should come visit with your family. I'll pick you up from the airport and we'll show you firsthand.
You how many car seats do you have?
We can make it work. I have at least 2 car seats.
All right. Let's get it.
My co-founder at the park, Rod, has he's on the verge of having a basketball team worth of children. So very family oriented over here in Nashville. I've thought about that perspective a lot, on like the sovereign individual thesis and families and tribes and local communities. And I think when you empower individuals, I think it's inherently a grassroots, bottom up philosophy and process, and it inherently empowers families. It empowers the family unit. It empowers local communities. It empowers tribes, rather than this overarching centralized, naturally trending to corrupt, large governance body that is nation state governance right now. And I think the result is a much better world. It's hard to kind of, if you lived in the existing world, particularly in the developing world, I mean, there's still places in the world where local communities and tribes kind of come first. It's hard to really fathom what that kind of world looks like, but that's how humanity has existed for the overwhelming majority of our existence. And it only seems natural that we'd go back to at least something that looks similar, right?
Yeah. You know, it's that was wonderfully said. There's another comment I kind of want to make on top of that, because I feel like it's worth being acknowledged.
Go for it.
Did you see that video? I just saw this video today of this guy who might have like essentially lost his pension. At least that's how it was being framed. Did you see that video?
No, I have not watched it, but
okay. Well, it's essentially this guy, you know, who they're in some type of warehouse, I recall, and he's upset, right, about, you know, some pension reductions, you know, and I can't remember where I saw it on whose page it was, you know, and he's, you know, he's cursing and people are posting it like, you know, this is what happens, you know, when people depend on pensions their entire lives, and you know, the companies which were supposed to be investing their pensions, you know, mismanaged funds, et cetera, whatever. And at first glimpse, when I saw that video, I thought about it the same way. But now as I kind of reflect on it, you know, particularly in light of our conversation that we're having right now, is, you know, there is, when I went back to the village in Nigeria, I noticed most people don't have pensions. Most people don't have insurance. Their pensions, their insurance is their neighbor. It's the people that live next to them. Right? So when we talk about, you know, essentially this communal responsibility, right, or tribes, right, having this strong sense of communal responsibility, and like they're baked into that can be mutual aid, right? And if you can build this sense of interdependence, right, you can encourage individuals to exercise their sovereignty in ways that benefit the collective, right? And you can foster, right, through leadership, of course, right, a balance between personal freedom and communal well-being. And I just think these are things which, you know, I think have historically been thought about in black or white, right? Nobody wants to get into the nuance. They just want to tag something with a certain level of framing, right? But I think there's an incredible opportunity right now, you know, with the level of fanaticism, you know, in Bitcoin to build cultural sovereignty, right? We can build that now because, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, that you weren't a spiritual person. I want to push back on you on that. Because when I think about what, you know, why is Bitcoin captivated me so deeply, right? And how is it that this technology and lines of code, right, have, you know, they have had this power, right? And I think is it because Bitcoin fundamentally, within its rules, mirrors a natural experience. It's the human experience cyclically, which we go through forever and ever, right? For years and thousands of years. So there's a term called biomimicry, right? And are you familiar with that term?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, for those who are listening, bios means life and mimesis means to imitate, right? So most of the, you know, the greatest technologies, you know, whether it's like, you know, certain the aerodynamics of planes or even Velcro, right? Like these things ultimately came from man observing nature. Right. And then building his fashioning things, you know, to build technology. Right. And when I think about Bitcoin, it fits that same ethos. Right. So what we're experiencing, those who are awake and who understand what Bitcoin can be, right, not just as a function of money, you know, but as a protocol. Right. Like that is a spiritual moment. That is it, right? So I think if you get Bitcoin, right, particularly from the level I've heard you eloquently communicate, Matt, right, sir, you are here on that journey, just like all of us are. We're all on this journey, you know. So again, I'm being long-winded, but I'm excited to talk to you. I don't know if you can tell.
The feeling is mutual, brother. I guess my point is that I am very much learning, and I'm very much in a process of improvement on that front. Hmm. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, my wife is not. My wife is incredibly spiritual and very connected. And I'm just constantly trying to do better for myself and for her and our family. And I just it's just something that I do battle with. Just that constant improvement and just like this idea of, for better or for worse, what we both got ourselves wrapped up in, which is this society that is dominated by social media and being connected and the dopamine hits of notifications and having your phone on. We're talking about a 40-day fast, not eating food and only consuming water for 40 days. Like, how much of America can do a 40-day fast of social media or their cell phone? Just turn off their cell phone for 40 days.
Yeah.
And I don't know the last time I turned off my cell phone for 40 days. So mm-hmm. It's important for me to keep myself in check and humble in that way that I probably should. But I haven't, and why haven't I, and where do my priorities lie and where do I take it from there? Right.
Yeah. Well, can I make it practical?
Yeah, go for it. I think I like practical.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. So I like, let's say like, I think sometimes when people are mentioning spiritual things, it almost feels like it's, you know, it's, you know, you're holier than thou, or, you know, you're, you know, it's just kind of a woo woo type of ordeal. But like, I want to put it in practical terms. And I think this is, this can be helpful for many people. Because I've been working through this concept, and it came to me in the last couple of days in the fast, particularly as I was having, you know, watching my family eat, and I'm there. We eat together, right? So whether we're eating or not, we're always sitting at the table. My wife and the kids and whoever is at our house, we're going to sit at the table. We don't. It's never. You go over here. You go over here. Like, no, we sit together. We commune. And I had this thought. I said, well, I think the most sacred space, right, in a person's home is a kitchen. And like, let's just think about this for a moment, right? There's an act of preparing sustenance for yourself and your loved ones, right? That's an offering. That's a sacred ritual that connects us to our primal nature, right? So like, okay, I'm gonna see if I can reframe this. Imagine this, like, in a kitchen, there are pots and pans, there are utensils and spices, right? And this operates as this sacred altar where the essence of your life, like your effort, your labor, your resources are all being transformed into an edible dish, right? And like, I really want to kind of like hone in on this, right? But for those who are listening, and if you're like me, you got, you know, your podcast on like 2x, right? I want you to slow down and hear this, because I think this is an important key, right? Is in the kitchen, stories unfold, right? It's where generations of people, my mother or a grandmother, they whisper their wisdom, right? They give you their ancestors' traditions, and they're woven into every fabric of the recipe, right? The kitchen is where laughter and tears and celebration, and you go through all of life's rhythms. And, you know, I actually have memories that are infused into everything that I've eaten. Right? Like, there are things in which are very euphoric for me. Right? And to me, that is the spirit, right? That is, right, those experiences. Right, the understanding that in this realm, and by me in this realm, I mean the kitchen, right, is, it's where sustenance becomes sustenance for the soul. And I think for anyone who has a child can understand this, right, that it is a sacred service, a gesture, right, when you feed your children. It does something to you, right? It reminds you of this interdependence that exists in our society, you know, and I think it's possible for anyone to live in that. Anyone, right? When you're in the kitchen, you're in a sacred place because you're communing, right? And the community is a sacred act, whether it's from plate all the way to seed, right? It involves our efforts, our labor, our essence. You know, so I want to encourage you and anybody listening, you know, we are spiritual people, right? We're dealing with much more than we can actually see. And, you know, forgive me, I'm imposing my own ideas, you know, but I hope that it helps somebody.
Well, we're all here to listen to your ideas, so.
Thank you for the floor, man. Usually in sports interviews, they cut you off and you got somebody like in the back.
You're forgiven. Yeah, I'm not going to ask you about the play. That was a great play. Like, obviously, what else are you going to say?
All right. One more thing, though.
That's funny. Sports interviews. Continue.
I've seen what you've been saying in regard to the blue check stuff, man.
Oh, really?
Dude, you're right. You're absolutely right. I think it's going to be horrible, right? What can ultimately come from this, right? And like, I got a blue check.
I'm aware.
Right. I know you're aware. I, you know what? I knew you weren't going to give me a passport, so I'm bringing it up first. But look, right, here's the reality, right, is I think in Bitcoin, right now, at least in the industry, I think we got to figure out ways to, you know, to reach across the aisle, right? Like, we need leadership in a different form of ways, right? And like, in some ways, man, I'm taking this blue check so my kids don't need to take a blue check, right? You know, like I don't want them to be online, to be honest with you, right? So for me, like, I, there are things in which, you know, it benefits people. The algorithm can benefit people, and things which can be built on. And I just hope that people can see the real me. They don't just see the blue check, right? Like, I'm going to make this thing work for as best as I can, because I know that ultimately I'm building a community, right, of people, right? And they can benefit from the things that I can put my attention and my effort to, right? So I respect people on both sides, you know? I respect people who, you know, who are doing the blue check thing and who aren't, you know? I respect people on all ends, man. And thanks for giving me that pass, bro.
I was not going to bring it up.
Well, okay.
I kind of want to talk about, I mean, you said it, you'd rather your children not be on the internet. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I wrestle with, social media addiction, all the negatives of our digital connected lives, and the addiction we have to the little computer in our pocket, the little surveillance device in our pocket. Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, the power of freedom tech and the power of being a part of that movement, and not wanting our children to be completely unequipped for the world that comes. I mean, if we think that we're digitally connected now, I don't think we can really fathom what, you know, 20 years in the future looks like, or 40 years in the future looks like. How do you balance, like, how do you think about that?
It's a good question. It's a hard question, and one that I like to wrestle with every day. And we've done a pretty good job, you know, keeping the children away from, you know, screens and technology. We got rid of our television. You know, the most they see our phones is like when we're on it, my wife and I. We've also noticed, now that we have limited our screen time, you know, the amount of the conversations we have, like, you know, we homeschool our children, you know, so we're the ones educating them, you know, so everything is interactive. It's hands on,
right?
We're constantly more dealing with people. Cause I think when you say yes, you know, to using more digital technologies, you're saying no to physical interaction. And like, I understand, you know, people see Bitcoin as this, you know, internet native currency. And I think it has its place. And I'm not going to, you know, not acknowledge, right, that we are looking at essentially a digital form of technology that can be used, you know, but I think it's meant to just be used, you know, and not the other way around. We don't want to allow it to use us. So I really believe this takes a certain level of discipline. You know, and we make commitments, you know, at least, you know, one day we honor the Sabbath, one day out of the week, no technology, everything's off. And man, it has been incredible. And I'm going to offer you the same invite. If you and your wife are ever, you know, out here, come stay with us, man. We turn everything off and we have a good time, and we color, we paint, things I haven't done since I've been a child, man. We find ways to, you know, to have fun, right? And to do what we used to do as children, right? When things were so much more simple, you know? So I'm still learning, man. And if you have any tips, I'll take some from you too.
I'm learning from you on this front. We're definitely going to take you up on that offer. It means a lot.
You're welcome, man. We have extra space. You can stay with us if you like.
We've both been wanting to meet your family for a while now. I try not to get personal on the show, but it was really special how we met. The first time me and you met was also the first time you met my wife. My wife was with me. We met you together.
Yeah.
For the Indy 500, with Jack Mallers.
Yeah.
And the Bitcoin car. That was a crazy fucking whirlwind.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was my first time going to a racing event. It's a weird way to experience a whole sport for the first time. Like at the top. I mean, we were on the track, you know, we're in the owner's suite. It kind of just sets like this super high bar. And then you just, if you go to a racing event after that, you're like, oh, wow, I peaked on my first time.
Yeah. Did you remember when I was, I kind of thought like all professional sports are the same. So like we go down to, what's that area called? You know, where like they have the pit stops and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, the pit.
Yeah. And like we, who's, what was the other bank that was it? PBC Bank?
It was PNC.
PNC. PNC Bank. And I see their driver and like, I just start talking trash to him. And I'm thinking like, that's what people do. Like you talk trash to the opposing team, like to kind of get in their head and to get them out of their game. And like, everybody was looking at me like, why are you talking trash to this dude? I'm like, isn't this what people do? And he was upset. Like he was pissed, you know? And like, and I remember like one of the owners took me aside. It's like, hey, it's not, this isn't football. Like we don't really do that here.
Yeah, it is interesting, the different sports.
And yeah, it was pretty funny.
The different cultures that they have. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that was, anyway, to our family, it was always special that my wife and I met you at the same time.
Without a doubt. Yeah, you were special people. You were
very special. Thank you, sir. Can we just dive a little bit into like the actual, experience of not eating food for 40 days? Your family was still eating. You were sitting at the dinner table together, which, by the way, I think is a, relatively low lift, massive life improvement to insist on that, at the very least. What was the hardest part? I mean, like, what did you do? You were literally just sitting there while they ate around you. Did that make it more difficult? Did that make it easier?
Yeah, I think the first couple of days, like, so really, I would say for anybody who likes to kind of go about it, this, they want to fast, the first 4 days are the hardest, you know, and, you know, after that, you really don't have any challenges. But conceptually, like, food is a cornerstone to most community gatherings, right? You know, so when I'm sitting at the table with my family, they're eating, and those first couple of days, man. And my kids are always hungry. They're big boys. Like, they're always hungry. So I'm always feeding in my hand. And like, I got to the point where I had to tape my mouth shut because I would be feeding them. And like, they drop something. You just kind of eat it. You know, like, so I had to like tape my mouth shut, you know, and then everything smells good. And the body is just like crying out and saying, feed me. You know, and I wanted to be in control. Like, I wanted to dictate things to my body. So a lot of it's mental, right? And there are some physical challenges. You know, you get headaches. You'll deal with bouts of frustration. You can be irritable. You know, and then all the while, you know, you're losing weight, right? There are periods in which you go through acidosis. So, you know, you'll have these moments where you lose a ton of energy, you can't do anything, you know, and then you make a turn and you have all the energy in the world. It's a crazy experience what the body, you know, can do, man. I'm increasingly more impressed right, with what I think our abilities are, you know. But it's you know, I wish I could say it's easy, you know, but like, I think sometimes it depends on like, what do you want more? Like, I knew I wanted something for my family and for myself, right, and for the world, right? So I really had to hold on to these things. You know, I had to build accountability systems around me. You know, people that I said that I would reach out to certain people and I'd say, hey, I need you to encourage me, because there's going to come a point in time where I'm going to feel like giving up. And I'm going to say, this is dumb, this is stupid. You know, so that's another thing. You know, so one is build accountability systems, right? The second thing is recognize that your body is going to change. Right? You are, at least for the first couple of days, you know, you're essentially addicted, right? The amount of ways in which we consume, at the pace we consume, like, you're a foodaholic, right? So, you know, what do they say? That the first step to, you know, any form of recovery is, you know, you have to admit, right, that this is a challenge, right? So it's, you know, it's admission, you know, that, you know, food, right, does, and consumption does have power over us, right? It's essentially another form of God, right, that exists within our bellies. You know, and then the third thing is, yo, enjoy the ride. You know, because on the other side, you know how much clarity you receive when you're not bogging yourself down with food. I didn't realize how much time I spend eating or preparing to eat, right? Whether that is groceries or trying to figure out what we're going to eat. And, you know, I'll say this, and before anybody feels this way, asking my wife to eat what she wants to eat is one of the worst things ever. What do you want to eat? I don't know. What do you want to eat? Like, you know how much time you spend going back and forth trying to figure out what you want. Anyway, I just threw this in there for her because I know she'll listen later. You know, but yes, you know, enjoy the ride.
But you got to skip that process because you weren't eating.
Yeah,
40 days.
Right. Yeah. So then she's like, she was still asking me, what should we eat? I'm like, I don't know. What do you want to eat?
I'm not participating.
I'm not doing it. Go ahead. You guys figure it out. You know, so she still wants an answer, but it's all good.
I try and honor questions I see in the live chat. And now we have two dueling live chats right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm not looking at live chat. I apologize.
You're good. I'm looking at it. Someone asked, like, how you spent your days if you weren't eating, which is crazy. I mean, I think a lot of people do build their days around when they're having food.
Without a doubt, man.
Like, were you still working out? Were you still lifting? I know that was a major part of your life. Has always been a major part of your life. Like, how were you spending the days?
Yeah, I would still, you know, so in the mornings I would get up. You know, so I'm getting up roughly like 5, sometimes 4:30 a.m. And I would try to spend some personal time just reflecting on like anything which I've had challenges on, you know, in the past, or, you know, maybe what I'm presently looking at, you know. And then the kids wake up anywhere between like 6 and 6:30. But I try to like I wanted to work out, you know, so for the first 20 days, I was getting after it. So cardio, you know, weightlifting, and not doing in moderation, you know, walking. I you know, in some ways, sprinting and jogging. Like, I kept a pretty active lifestyle. Because I knew I needed to sweat. Like, I could feel these toxins coming out of me, right? So, like, I wanted to really, you know, circulate the blood flow. I think it's, you know, important to do those type of things. And then the second thing is like, you know, I know people assume that, you know, hey, I play in NFL and I don't work, right? I don't have things that I'm building, you know, and that's a complete fallacy. Like I'm still building. I am still, I still have a commitment, right, to the world, right, to the family, to generate income and to stack more sats. Like, I'm still very responsible for that. You know, so like there is no laying down all day and feeling sorry about myself, you know, because I'm not eating. You know, and so really I'd orient my days around, you know, one, taking time to reflect, right? Obviously the family component, which I've been hammering on, you know, and building, you know, and then lastly, just, you know, there's a lot of prayer, man. There's a lot of looking inwardly, at nighttime. I didn't really sleep too well, you know, during these fasts. I don't know what it is, you know, that I think there are, maybe by scientific means, you know, because you're not eating so much and burning so much food, you probably don't need as much rest, you know. So I was very energized at nights, so I kept things going pretty well, at least for the first 20 days. After that first, I hit day 23, and I was tanking bad.
At day 23.
Yeah.
Was that to be expected? Is that a...
Well, for me, it's been a challenge. And both of my two long-term fasts, day 23, I don't know what it is about that day. It's always been very challenging.
Well, I mean, I obviously this is not based in science since you survived. But I've always heard the 3 minutes without air. No, 3 weeks without water, 3 months without food. So mm-hmm. I guess you were drinking water the whole time.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's a connection there. 3 weeks and 3 weeks without water, you die.
Man.
Oh, no, 3 days without. It's 3 minutes, 3 days, and 3 weeks, I thought was the law of threes, that if you don't have food for 3 weeks, that's when you start deteriorating.
I think, I know some people who've done a dry fast for seven days.
No right. Water even?
No water. And I mean, this is like it's so hard right now to get accurate information.
Like, yeah, that's true.
Fiat science is real.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're looking at the situation which happened to COVID, and you know, there are people on both sides of the spectrum, you know, but I think something that I think both sides are acknowledging, those who are pro and against, is that we need to take a very deep look at how our medical system works. And I would even say if anybody wants to do more research on this, like go back, study Pasteur and Beauchamp. Right, study them, right? And you know, Matt, like there's, you know, like the whole Tesla Edison debate, right?
Of course.
You know, and it's essentially a rivalry which has become a symbol, right, for a clash between like innovation and like what the establishment is. So while like Tesla was known for his pioneering work in like alternating currency and electricity systems, you know, wireless communication and all these other kind of groundbreaking things. You know, Edison was thought about, you know, more as an inventor who was very politically inclined, right, and took a different approach in regards to electrical distribution, right? And there's the same type of concept, right, built into the medical system, where it's called germ theory versus biological terrain. And it's a debate between two men and ultimately two ideologies, you know, really known as the Pasteur versus Beauchamp debate. And, without grossly simplifying it, right? Pasteur was known as a person who believed in, you know, this kind of germ theory for disease. And he proposed it as essentially external germs and microbes, they invade the body, ultimately causing, you know, various illnesses, right? And to combat these germs, you know, we see what we see now is many pharmaceutical interventions like drugs, vaccinations, and surgeries, et cetera. While versus Beauchamp, right, he held a different perspective, suggesting that there are these, you know, small particles called microsomas and in cells, which ultimately change form and function, right, and, you know, can exist or become toxic, right, in an unhealthy body terrain. You know, so, you know, that instead of seeing germs as, you know, bad or evil, right, you see germs or bacteria as opportunistic, right? And it's a way in which the body, right, can, you know, push out weaknesses or certain imbalances. And so I'm not going to sit here and argue whether there is a, you know, for or against the traditional form of medicine, you know, but I just want to let people know, right, that, you know, these debates that we've had, particularly when it comes to the medical industry now, like these things have been going on for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, right? And I think we want to be very careful, right, in terms of our understanding of where many of these ideologies come from, you know, and then ultimately what they end up growing into. You know, so, you know, when I think about, you know, dry fasting, like I know people who they dry fasted for a week, right? Like, versus, and I've seen, I thought the same thing. Like, nobody can live without water for 3 days, you know, and it's not true. People can, you know, so, okay. I finally looked at the chat, you know, somebody made a Mandibles shout out. Yeah. I love Mandibles. It's a great book.
Also love Mandibles.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good book. Really good book.
But yeah, they were Diogenes the Great was clarifying what I was saying, which was 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. Mm. I've heard that many times in my life. Mm. I will say that I relate with that it's incredibly difficult to do your own research in terms of medical science and nutrition and all the associated fields. There's just so much ingrained bias everywhere. And it's hard to dig through that and come to your own conclusions, but it's imperative that people do.
Yes, man. And then it's actually something I want to ask you that I'm really trying to work through, you know, and you would have much more of an understanding of the technical components. And think about, and I'm bringing this up based on what you're saying, so trust me, I have somewhere I'm going with this. But like this whole thing about ordinals, I think it's very interesting. What's your perspective, right, in terms of like where like a lot of the pushback from ordinals is coming from? Like I'm just trying to understand it, right? So I'm as much I have to learn about it, right? But you know, it's my understanding that like I thought Bitcoiners want the free market to work, right? And they're all for, you know, getting things out into the competitive marketplace, right? So I'm just trying to like work through that. And like, maybe because I haven't been in some of these rooms, you know, but like, I heard the pod you did with that, that
Casey.
Yeah. I heard that. I listened to it, you know? And you seem to be very balanced, right, in your perspective. I don't know if that's where you still stand, you know, but like, I'm just kind of curious to know, like after that conversation, like where has your mind been at?
Still Dispatch 91, with Casey Rod Armor. The creator of ordinals. I mean, it's really interesting because Casey came up with it, but Casey's kind of at least taken a step back publicly from the project. Mm-hmm. Partially because of like who it's been captured by. And I think that's where a lot of people have issues. Ordinals is a little bit interesting because, first of all, I did not think we were going to be talking about this today.
No, me neither. But I was just like, so you have a great perspective. You know,
fair enough. I mean, it's interesting because it's really two separate things, right? So you have something called inscriptions, where you can encode whatever data you want to encode into the Bitcoin blockchain. If we're correct about Bitcoin, the Bitcoin blockchain will outlive us all. I think there is merit maybe merit's the wrong word, but there is data that people are going to want to inscribe in this ledger that lasts forever, that they think has value. And there's a free market that dictates whether or not they can inscribe that in the ledger, and that's the fee market. And if they're willing to pay the Bitcoin required for the transaction fee to inscribe that data, then there's nothing we can do to stop it.
Okay.
That's the beauty of Bitcoin, right? It's it can be used without permission. There's no gatekeepers. There's no central authority. And as a result, people can inscribe data on the chain. Ordinals is this separate theory that Casey came up with. To basically denote ownership of the different inscriptions, and as a result, be able to transfer ownership of the different inscriptions. He calls it ordinal theory. It does not exist on chain. It does is not enforced by the Bitcoin protocol. It's completely separate of Bitcoin itself. It is this essentially this numbering scheme that they came up with and agreed with in terms of who owns which inscription. Naturally in the way Bitcoin works, you can inscribe that data on chain, but you can't transfer ownership of that data. Everyone has access to that data.
Okay.
So my issues mostly stem from people trying to sell ownership of different data objects. I mean, the most common case is NFTs, or like some kind of artwork. And they sell it via this ordinal mechanism. And I just don't think there's actually any ownership transfer. And I think that a lot of people do it in scammy ways in terms of trying to sell someone an item that really can't be transferred ownership-wise. So it's mostly my issue, like mostly stems from the promoters and who has kind of gravitated towards it. But I do think... I think there's some novel uses for inscriptions that we kind of haven't really seen yet, because it's mostly been focused on dumping garbage on people. And that is just the reality that you have to kind of come to grips with if you're involved in the greater freedom tech movement in general, which is that when you have tools that promote freedom, you will find a lot of like-minded individuals that care about individual freedom, but you'll also find a lot of malicious actors who will take advantage of the freedom that provides to try and take advantage of other people. And it's just the unfortunate reality. Like, that is just the reality you have to live in, and you kind of have to take the bad with the good. Otherwise, you won't get the good part. And I think the good part massively outweighs the bad part. And I mean, we see this with Bitcoin too. We've heard it many times in the past. Bitcoin has kind of grown up past this, but I expect it to happen many times in the future as Bitcoin gets adopted, which is you pick a particular individual or group and they're using Bitcoin for something that you disagree with or might be illegal. And you try and paint a large swath on all Bitcoin users and you say, if this terrorist group is using this money, that it's not freedom money, it's terrorist money. But at the end of the day, freedom money can be used by anybody without permission. And the overwhelming majority of people are using it to benefit their lives and are using it in a objectively moral way. Or I don't even know if there's such a thing as objectively moral, but that are using it in a positive way and a force for good. But some bad actors will still use it, right? And maybe that ratio is skewed very differently in the inscriptions and ordinals world, where the majority of early adoption has at least been. And maybe that's the key. Maybe the key is with these tools, a lot of times the early adoption is by malicious actors. You don't really see the positive adoption until later on.
Right. Right. And I just kind of want to kind of stand on this, so, you know, maybe people can understand what I think about it.
Yeah.
It does. Like, I want to see the space grow. And I say the space Bitcoin grow. Right. So I think this involves less purity tests, right? Less of the infighting, right? And more education and evangelism, even if it's on different forms, right? And I think we need more leadership in this area, right? And ultimately, fasting has helped open my eyes, right, to this reality. And like, I come from the sports world, right? So I've had exposure, you know, to a world of collectibles. I understand why, like, you know, people like these inscriptions or urnals, and they're popular. And I get it. It's triggering for, you know, many people who are purist, right? Or consider themselves purists. But I'm actually excited about people working on Bitcoin, because I think free markets ultimately end up winning. And I think there's an opportunity to start trying to capture, you know, what I think has always been wasted market share, and bring people more in, right, in different ways. And even going back to like what I think about, you know, what I was saying about Pasteur and Beauchamp and these two lines of thinking, like, let's just consider like the hieroglyphs, right, in Egypt in the pyramids, right? The hieroglyphs were seen as a system of writing, right, or using pictorial symbols to represent words, sounds, or ideas, right? And they were also meant to serve as a documentation of historical events, whether it's religious beliefs or, you know, people's way of life, right? And hieroglyphs were a permanent and distributed ledger, okay? And I see the Bitcoin blockchain working the same way. It's decentralized and mutable ledger, right? So when a person like Beauchamp and all his ideas are essentially erased from history, right? Like, can you imagine his ideas living on top of literally the best, you know, blockchain in the world? Like, can you imagine a host or a network of computers distributed across the world to verify what has transpired and happened in chronological order? Right? And I think that's the beauty of something else Bitcoin can offer, right? Is it is this information storage that can withstand the test of time and preserve valuable data for future generations. Our libraries, right? And I say us, I mean people like you and me, Matt, who love this space. The blockchain will be our libraries, right? These things will exist. If we believe Bitcoin is what people say it is, like, we got to put our hieroglyphics on the wall, you know? So I don't actually know what that looks like, you know, specifically for, you know, for me, you know, but I think it's worth some consideration. I do think people should think about it.
Yeah. You know, we have similar perspectives there. I mean, I tend to agree. That's why I say, I don't think the positive use cases have really been explored much. It's mostly at this current early stage of adoption, it's been mostly malicious actors, in my opinion. And that's my read. And I would say, just as a pushback in terms of, you know, this idea of big tents and being more welcoming and less purity tests. I mean, the purity tests are, can be very infuriating at times. Mm-hmm. I would say, I think that is larger than Bitcoin. It's part of this internet culture that has, developed, where, you know, it's not a neighbor talking to a neighbor or someone shaking someone else's hand and looking them in the eye. It's a stranger holding a high standard that they're not even holding themselves to some stranger on the internet.
Yeah.
And getting engagement points off of that. And that's very common. But if we're moving to a world with more freedom tech and more freedom and more independence and more free markets and less overreaching, centralized, corrupt governance, then we're also going back to a world where people need to self-police more and operate in high integrity and stand up and say something if they think something's unfair. And I think, depending, you know, maybe the pendulum has swung a little bit in terms of the quote unquote crypto industry and the industry at large, you know, maybe bigger than Bitcoin. But for the overwhelming history of Bitcoin and then crypto, it's actually been the opposite. Most of the time, anyone that has any kind of platform or any kind of audience or any kind of voice or influence in the space has tend to turn a blind eye when malicious actors fleece naive new users. And it's like a you scratch my back, I scratch your back, and we all make a lot of money and the average person gets fucked. And I think if anything, there's probably a shortage of larger voices that are willing to call out and keep honest other large voices in this space that tend to focus on trying to take advantage of people. And that's kind of the balancing act to try and find. It's something that I take quite seriously, because I like to focus on things that other people aren't doing, to make my short time on this world worth it. But, I you know, like if you believe in free markets, if you believe in free markets, then, you know, you objectively do not believe in something like the SEC deciding on what people can invest in.
All facts.
Right. So then the alternative is trying to provide quality information to people so that they can make an educated decision on their own. And I think there's the way the incentives are set up, the way incentives in general are set up in terms of making money in this space, it tends to be that people aren't willing to put their own neck on the line to try and call out, you know, outright scams and frauds, and we need more people doing that, and that's the balance, kind of. That makes sense.
I wonder if that sort of calling, you know, some of these concepts out, you know, maybe there's a way to, I don't want to frame this, maybe there's a way, you know, maybe the best way to call them out is to build something better.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's, when I think about this sort of this free market of, you know, it's a free market of ideas, right? And ideology as well, right? Like, we are competing for the minds of people.
Right.
You know, and I think that's something that we need to pay attention to is, you know, these traditional players and, you know, what people frame as centralized systems, they have a very large market share, you know, and the bandwidth of most of the most people, right? So, like, we have to be much more crafty, right, and intelligent about how we want to deliver things. I've actually seen beautiful things being built,
right? Right?
But they can't get any liquidity. They can't get anybody to pay attention to their project, right? So I think we need to think much more, you know, creatively about some of these problems. And I think that's where the leadership comes from. That's what I've seen from you, Matt. When you brought Casey on, like I didn't know who else was I going to listen to, right? I'm going to listen to you because I know, you know, you're going to give him the right platform to say what he needs to say, right? And I'm not saying you need to agree with him, right? But your delivery and your approach to it wasn't, hey, this is dumb, this is against big. No, it's an attack. No, it was, say what need you say. You push back, you know, where you needed to, right? But ultimately, the free market's going to decide what it needs to decide. And I think the issue is so many Bitcoiners forget how much they know, and then they assume everyone else gets it.
Right.
But most people are far from getting it. Right. And they forget about the mantra in which you say every day. Actually, I don't know if you still say it every day. Right. Stay humble.
Continue.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, stay humble. Stay humble. That's the mantra. Stay humble.
Yeah, I mean, I stopped. I did it 279 days in a row, and then I got frustrated with Twitter's new policies, and I decided I didn't want to support the platform anymore with the daily mantra.
Well, I love it.
I still live it every day, I'll tell you that much, and I hope other people do as well. And it's not me saying that I am humble. It's me reminding myself that I need to stay humble. To the haters out there who say that I'm not humble, I'm aware. I'm working on it.
It takes different forms, man. It takes different forms.
But Russ, like the other, I know, like our time is coming close here, but I just a couple more things. You know, the other balance is that, Like, I think that freedom, I think humanity trends to freedom long term. I think people will trend to freedom tech naturally when they realize the need for it. But the way I kind of look at it is another balancing act is that the natural tendency is to get burned and touch the stove and feel pain. And that's when you realize the need. And this is when this kind of tech gets adopted. And if there's ways for us to avoid that process, and avoid that pain before the benefits, that is obviously advantageous. Like I would prefer a world where less people feel pain in order to reach a better place. And I think that's kind of, that's what I try and balance with almost this idea of, there's almost like this, there's this undercurrent within specifically the Bitcoin community that is, can be quite paternalistic, where it's like, where instead of letting your child learn on his own, it's do this. And then when they ask you why, you say, because I say so, which I think is, can be counterintuitive and not very helpful. And I try and, I don't know, be as productive as possible in those constraints. On the positive side, in terms of tools and solutions, it would behoove me to, I don't even know if I use that phrase right. I don't know, whatever. I need to bring up with you before we end, are you familiar at all with Nostr?
Dude, I it's been across my dashboard, but like I haven't really like dove into it really deep. Like I know what are these guys? I just got their node, man. I wanted to support them. You know, and I'm not affiliate, I'm not invested with this company at all, but shout out to Start9. You know, that they're I think they're doing some good work. I think a lot of people are doing good work, you know. But that was like the first time I saw like Nostr on something. So like, I don't even know like how to get set up. There's such a disparity in regards to the information, you know, onboarding that I don't conceptually get. One thing I do is I love it's open source. I love that there are ways to move users seamlessly from, you know, I guess app to app, right? And that it's going to open a realm of new possibilities, but like I'm looking to learn more.
So you're on iPhone, right?
Both. I'm on multiple things. Well, as I've learned from you on your privacy website.
There you go. On iPhone, if you go to primal.net/downloads, they have an iPhone test flight of their Nostr app. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good place to start. You basically just install the app and then follow the steps to create a key. Similar to Bitcoin, you get a private key. Everyone knows you by the public key. Mm-hmm. Nostr is this like, amazing interoperable communication protocol that's permissionless, similar to Bitcoin in that way. That's completely open source that people can build on top of, so apps can communicate with each other using the standard. It can be used for many, many different things. I think a lot of the ways Nostr will be used, we can't really even comprehend yet. Humans love social media. So one of the major first use cases of it is essentially creating an interoperable competitor to Twitter, to Instagram, to TikTok, to Reddit, all using the same standard, but how they render different posts and whatnot are based on the social media they're competing with. So what does that mean? That means that we can have a broadcast medium, we can have a social media that is not controlled by an individual company, that cannot be pressured by governments, that cannot force you to do identity verification to have reach, that has Bitcoin payments directly built in so that you can get payments directly without a middleman and free to money. So the left hand part of our screen right now is this Nostr enabled live chat, which you can get at sildispatch.com/stream. It uses this service called zap.stream. But why do I bring this up? I bring this up because the guy who created it, the two guys who created it, or at least led the creation of zap.stream, Kieran and Carnage, basically had this open protocol, and they were able to build out this service that we're using live on air right now in a matter of days, because they didn't require permission from anyone, and it's censorship resistance by default, and it's open. And the power that that can bring is pretty substantial. So as much as I complain about Elon's policies, as much as I complain about the past regime's policies when they were in charge of Twitter and all the shadow bans that they did, and now the shadow bans that Elon's doing on anyone who doesn't verify their identity, I do it from a place of optimism and a place of hope, because the reason I care that Twitter is making these policies is because I've always thought of Twitter as a platform that, even though centralized, and even though it has its own trade-offs and issues, a platform that promotes freedom, that promotes new thought, that promotes open discussion. And that is waning, but fortunately we do have a alternative in Nostr, and it's very early days of Nostr. It's just been incredibly impressive watching it get built out by open source contributors around the world. The dev mind share is absolutely crazy. So I would just suggest you check it out. No pressure, I think. But I do think that I do think that it's the future.
Yeah. Okay. So I would just say, you know, any of the devs who are working on Nostr, like, hit me up. My DMs are open. Like, I'm gonna learn more about like how it works, like what can be done, you know, and then ultimately like how I can help this area grow, you know. So I'm down to do a lot more thinking, you know, around there. And like that's what I love about Bitcoin, you know, is you know, it's all proof of work, you know. Like, if you can show me what you're working on, like let's go, right? Like, I want to see this industry move ahead. I really do. And I think it sounds like to me, based on what you're saying, Matt, that like, you know, technologies like Nostr are going to be pivotal, right, to maintaining some form of freedom of speech, which we know is ultimately freedom of thought.
Yeah, I think it's just really complementary with Bitcoin, right? Where Bitcoin is the money protocol and Nostr is the speech protocol, and you need both for a free society. And I mean, there's plenty of situations where wallets and whatnot might, like Bitcoin wallets might communicate with each other with Nostr and stuff, and you'll see a lot of cross pollination and the two technologies kind of working together to both be more robust on their own. Mm-hmm. It's really fucking cool. I mean, talking about proof of work before we wrap, you have this website, okunfast.com.
Yeah.
What's your plan with that? What's your plan going forward? You know, what's next for us?
Yeah. So, I thought one of my kids is flipped out in the background. So like, you know, just so people know, a lot of, you know, like, I didn't really plan on being back on social for a long time.
Right.
I just wanted to come back on, like, due to 48 fast and say, yo, like, I did this, you know, this is why I did it. Like, just, you know, enjoy, you know, this process, whether you want to include yourself or not, right? It's there so people can see the journey, you know. But I've been getting so much, you know, feedback, right? And it's a lot of people who are very similar to me saying, look, I got kids, or I'm trying to make these lifestyle changes, I'm struggling, you know. Or saying, I've been to all these doctors, I've tried all these medicines, and nothing's working. And they're wanting to engage. You know, and it's been, you know, I didn't know what I was doing would be an ultimate gift. You know, so proof of work, right? And my friend, I want to shout him out here. I can't say his name, but he always tells me, mimic and mine the Bitcoin network, right? So if you can take these concepts in Bitcoin and attempt to live them out. Like, we both know that this technology works, right? And if humans can continue to align themselves, right, with what I'm going to say is a very archaic technology, you know, then things can be better. So, you know, when I created Okun Fast, right, very simply, it was to do that, just that. Is here's proof of work. Like, I am going to prove to you that day after day, I am putting this level of discipline in. You know, so, you know, I've been thinking about what's next. And, you know, we've been talking about, you know, maybe leading a 21-day Bitcoiner fast. You know, like, I think with the halvings coming up next year, maybe that might be something to consider, you know. Right. As, you know, for people who are saying, hey, like, I want to fast, you know, 3, 7, 10, you know, 14, you know, 21, whatever. Like, maybe just creating a space for them to do it, you know, do it with me. You know, so I'm doing a lot of thinking, you know, through that and trying to ensure that, you know, people have the proper resources, you know, as best as I can, you know. And man, I'd really be excited, you know, to have, you know, a lot of, you know, people who are interested, you know, in taking, you know, a very challenging but worthwhile step in life, you know, to do it with us.
That's amazing. 21 days so we don't hit the dreaded 23rd day.
Yeah, for sure.
Make it easy on us. Really amazing conversation, special conversation, Russ. Thank you for joining us. It's really impressive. You're really impressive. You're an inspiration. Yeah, just an honor and privilege. Massive love to you and your family. Hope to see you guys in person sometime soon. It's been way, way, way too long.
Too long. Too long.
And just thank you for joining us. Do you have any final thoughts for the freaks before we wrap?
Yeah, I just want to say, man, you guys have been awesome. You know, keep up this good work. You know, I think I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about what I think people are capable of, particularly in a world where, you know, I think artificial intelligence is very prevalent, you know, and, you know, everybody's talking about automation and da da da, right? Like, I think the most powerful part of technology, you know, are humans. And we have this divine code embedded within us. So that means the possibilities are endless. We need to build more things like Gloster. We are very capable, you know, of doing much more than we can ever dream of and achieve. So I'd like to thank the freaks. Thanks for your support, you know, and I look forward to doing much more in the Bitcoin industry. I'm very excited about it. So thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you, Russ. Much love. Appreciate you, freaks. Stay humble, stack sats. Cheers.